So again, welcome and thanks for joining us. We're joined in the committee room by myself, who's the Deputy Chair of the committee. My name's Colin Holt. We've got the Honourable Sam Rowe and the Honourable Tim Clifford. Also joining us is some committee staff, Alex. And we've also got Hansard in the room to record the oral evidence, so just so you're aware of that. Before we start, could you please state your full name and the capacity in which you appear before the committee?
Maybe I could just kick off. I'm Steve Farrell. I'm currently clerk to the Rural Economy and Connectivity Committee in the Scottish Parliament, but I do have line management responsibility for my colleague Ellen Russell, who's with us, and I also have a bit of background in petitions. In 1999, I was the clerk who set up the original public petitions system in the Scottish Parliament, and a few years later saw the introduction of the first electronic petitions system worldwide, I believe. So I do have a bit of background in petitioning, and certainly seen the value that this system has had throughout the Scottish Parliament's 20-year existence in terms of encouraging public engagement with the Parliament. I think it's been very successful, and over the years we have been engaging with lots of parliaments and legislators around the world to you know, give them the benefit of our experiences in petitioning systems, but also learn from what other institutions do also as they embark on their own petitioning systems. So it's been quite a journey over 20 years. And so I'll pass you over to my colleague Lynn, who is the person in the hot seat at the moment in our petition system, doing a wonderful job with our committee, so I'll let her introduce herself.
Okay, over to you, Ms. Russell.
Sorry.
Over to you.
Yeah, hi there. My name is Lynn Russell. I am the clerk to the Public Petitions Committee. I don't have quite as much experience as Steve in petitioning in the Scottish Parliament. I've been in the role for about a year, but have been in the team for longer than that in other roles. So I have a good understanding of the current circumstances with which we are handling public petitions, and I, on a day-to-day basis, lead the team that handles public petitions in Scotland. So I'm looking forward to sharing some of that knowledge with you all today, being, as it were, on the coal face, perhaps a little bit more than Steve, who has got a bit more strategic oversight of things.
Sure. I'm sure both perspectives will be valuable for us. You would have signed a document entitled Information for Witnesses. Have you read and understood that document?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
If for some reason you want to make a confidential statement, just let us know. I can't imagine, it's not a particularly controversial subject, but in case there's something controversial or something you'd like to keep in private evidence, let us know and we'll work out some way of taking that evidence down the track in a more secure environment. If you want to quote anything from a document, just name the full title of the document so that we can track it down for our records. And as it's being Skyped, hopefully everything goes smoothly and we won't lose connection too much and we'll be able to have a good two-way conversation. So just as a reminder, we are taking Hansard recording and taking the evidence today, and a transcript of today's discussions will be made public, but until the transcript of your public evidence is finalised, it should not be made public by you. So just having said all that, would you like to make an opening statement, or would you like to get straight into some of the questions we have?
I think we've probably covered most things, but I'll make a brief opening remark, if that's okay.
Sure.
Just like to say that we're grateful to you for extending this invitation to us to provide evidence to your committee on the Scottish Parliament's approach to public petitioning. We may pick up a bit more during the discussion as to what you're doing in Western Australia, so that will be interesting to us. But as I've mentioned, the public petition system has been a key feature of the Scottish Parliament since its opening in 1999, so we have a long-established approach to public petitioning in Scotland. Well, much has changed in the last 20 years in terms of the system works in practice, not least in terms of technology and the way we've used that the fundamental principles of ensuring that there's an open and accessible way for members of the public to raise awareness of an issue in the Parliament, or to try and change something about the way policy is operated or services are provided in Scotland, remains. And part of the committee's remit, an important part, and I think this is maybe where our two committees are looking at several issues at the moment, is a requirement to review how the public petition system works. And it's required us to carry out regular reviews of our systems and processes over the years. And indeed, we're currently reviewing and identifying opportunities to make further improvements to our own processes and procedures. And we may touch on some of this work as we provide responses to the committee today. So we look forward to sharing our knowledge and experience and maybe learning a bit more about how you operate petitions in Western Australia as we take forward our discussions.
Sure.
So thank you. That's all to say at the moment.
Thank you. And Ms. Russell, would you like to make any statement, opening statement?
No, Steve was happy to take the opening statement. So I think we're happy to go straight to questions now.
Yeah, sure. I might just make a slight detour. I do this quite often, so I apologise. I think way back in maybe 2010, some members of the Scottish Parliament came to Western Australia, and I think there were actually some members of the Petitions Committee, if I correctly remember, and it was at the time when you were just implementing e-petitions, I think. Did you come out with them, Steve, or?
I didn't. I've moved on by that time. The background to our electronic petition system is a lengthy one. Originally, I think it was back in 2001, 2002, we got our first system. And that was in cooperation with Heriot Watt University, a university in Edinburgh, who were very keen to look at engagement tools that they were developing. So we entered into a partnership with them. But I think you're correct that round about that time, 2008, 2009, I think that was the last major revamp of our petition system.
Yeah.
Where we certainly upped our game at that point, mainly because new technology was available to us to enhance our processes. And I think at that point we did, lead to a major revamp of our system.
Yeah.
And it's actually that system that came into place at that period that we're now looking at upgrading, essentially, in the coming year. We were actually engaged in an exercise to do that as we speak.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't get my trip to Western Australia.
No, no. Maybe next time. And just prompted me, when you were talking, it just prompted me to ask, if you've done a number of reviews of your processes over the years, have they been documented in any way that may be in a report that we could have access to?
Yes, we have conducted, I think it's an ongoing process. I think you see it's a constant evolution of the system. And then we respond to many things, whether it's as we see how the public responds to the petition system, and then whether they see any barriers to engaging with the Parliament, but also just in terms of how we manage the system within our clerking team to ensure that we apply resources effectively, and also responding to the needs of members as they consider petitions, whether improvements are required, whether we find it easier to understand the issue, understand the evidence that comes forward and reach conclusions.
Yeah.
But we carried out two major reviews. One was in 2009, and there was a report to support that, and we can send you a link to that. And more recently, in 2015, we carried out a further review, both underpinned by research which we had carried out on our behalf, and that is all documented. We can send that to you. And I think it may actually prompt, in looking at that information, it may prompt you to relate it to the same issues that you're looking at in terms of how you engage, how you ensure that there's a diverse range of petitioners that will engage with the Parliament, how you operate your own systems, how you can manage expectations of petitioners. I know these are issues that you're interested
in.
And these are issues that we have ourselves questioned ourselves as over the piece. And I think we'd probably be frank and say we haven't managed to address everything, but we're very alive to the issues and we're constantly trying to improve the system and the means of engagement.
Yeah. So I think those links to those reports would be really valuable for us, because we want to implement changes based on good rigour, good research and good thinking. So we should learn from you as much as we can. So just to follow on and get into some of the questions, I know you talked about the role, the valuable role that you play. How do the people of Scotland view the Petitions Committee and the role of petitions in the Parliament?
Well, maybe let Lynn take that one and I can maybe pitch in later.
I think it will come as no surprise that members of the public see it as a really vital tool to have their voice heard in Scotland. It's a platform from which to raise issues that perhaps haven't maybe had the attention elsewhere within the Parliament. So we actually have a number of petitions that the committee will consider where the issue maybe wouldn't have come up on a legislative programme or through a committee inquiry. So it's an alternative way for members of the public to really raise an issue of importance. And I know how important members of the public really view that to be, and having that very direct link in to the Scottish Parliament through, obviously, at first port of call, the clerking team led by me, and then obviously on to the committee members.
Yep. And I guess and when we talk about public expectation out of that process, how do you manage it as a how does the committee or the Parliament manage it to make sure that expectations are managed from those petitioners in particular?
Yeah, I think it's often the perception, just by the very nature of petitions, and often, well, in most cases, petitioners hold very strong views about the issues that they're raising with the Parliament. And often the perception can be that, you know, petitions will lead to big changes, such as the introduction of primary legislation or, you know, a new policy. But often the policies that petitioners are challenging are well established, they're put in place for good reason, they've been consulted upon, and a model has been introduced that actually meets the needs, particular needs in a particular policy area. So perhaps maybe the big sea changes and big dramatic improvements or changes often, you know, can't be achieved, and perhaps for good reason. But what we often find is that outcomes can be a bit more nuanced. And for example, a petition can lead to new or revised guidance being introduced to assist the public in engaging with a policy or a public service, an improvement in a policy or process, or perhaps a new strategy or extra funding for a particular area, which actually leads to improvement. So petitions may not lead to big, huge changes, but, you know, they may actually lead to small incremental improvements that can actually benefit the petitioner. But, you know, I think public expectations, particularly when people are angry and frustrated about particular things, have to be managed. And often it's really just about ensuring that petitioners have clear guidance about what the possible outcomes of the process can be. And I think what we pride ourselves in is having regular dialogue with the petitioner throughout the process so that they do always feel engaged. Clear updates at key stages of the process so there's an understanding of what decisions are being made and why, including an awareness of the evidence on which we base our decisions. And we publish that evidence online in relation to every petition, every piece of evidence we receive is itemised and put on our website. Mm. It's important that we also recognise the importance of ensuring that scrutiny is appropriate and proportionate when we receive petitions. Ordinarily, we go out to the Scottish Government to seek a reasoned response from them on the petition that's been submitted. And we also go out to other stakeholders in a particular policy area to get a different perspective on what's being called for. So another issue that perhaps we would touch on in terms of, you know, members' engagement with petitions is, you know, there's a view that, by keeping petitions open beyond the point where it becomes clear from the information that we've gathered that there's little likelihood of the objectives being met is not a particularly helpful, event. You know, the longer a petition is open, the expectations of petitioners can rise. So I think, you know, our message would be that where possible, where the evidence points to you know, closure of a petition or a referral of a petition to another committee, you know, that's perhaps a better outcome than just keeping a petition on the stalks, if you like, and it running for months and years.
Yeah. So to paraphrase would be deal with it in a fairly quick way and a decisive way that manages those expectations.
Lynn, you got anything to add?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to make the point that you may have picked up already that there is no one standard journey of a petition in Scotland. Mm-hmm. It can take lots of different twists and turns. Some might be closed quite quickly. The committee might want to really probe an issue further by gathering lots of evidence, either in oral form or written. You might want to do fact-finding visits or even write a report on something. But I think it's unfortunate sometimes that the attention, the media, really goes to the big ticket changes, like kind of legislative changes driven by public petitions. But as Steve's already mentioned, the success or an outcomes-focused approach isn't always through big legislative change. It can sometimes be, as Steve's already mentioned, the development of guidance or, you know, the way that a policy area is driven forward, it reflecting on the evidence from a public petition. So it's just, again, it's all about that kind of management of expectations and having that regular dialogue to explain that just because it happened for one petition, a different route might be taken for another petition, depending on the information and what's being presented to members.
Yeah, well, we have the same challenges here because you treat every petition on its merit, but it can go from wide-ranging issues to vexatious or frivolous matters. There's no set rule, I don't think, in a sense, which is one of the struggles of the committee, I think, in terms of how do we manage all those expectations or those different expectations in a parliamentary process as well. So, you know, that's why we keep reviewing and seeing if we can improve it more for the petition's outcome than anything else, I think.
I think, as Steve's touched on already, the importance is the evidence base from which the committee makes decisions. And because a lot of our work is out in the public domain, everything's minuted and recorded, and there's clear rationale as to why something's happened, it's perhaps not always going to be met with a positive reaction from the petitioner, but at least there's a clear understanding of why the committee have made the decisions they've made.
Yeah. One of the questions we had, which is question one, which was about the taking of oral evidence, it's probably rare that we do that in the first instance, but I know that there's a number of occasions where you move straight into oral evidence, and I'm probably interested in the decision making behind that. So when does it, and I don't know if you can provide any insight, but what sort of things does the committee consider when they go, let's go and take some oral evidence, or let's just get a written submission, or whatever it may be?
So it's perhaps obvious to state, but I will say that, you know, due to the time commitment involved in taking oral evidence from petitioners, it's just simply not possible to do that. So the committee do have to take a proportionate approach to hearing from petitioners. But when I was reflecting on this question, I think there's two main criteria that the committee take when they perhaps want to take oral evidence from a petitioner. The first of which is, again, if they don't have a huge amount of information about this issue, they will perhaps look to bring the petitioner in to mm-hmm. kind of probe that issue further and ask those questions, you know, in real time to really get behind what's driving the issue. So it's often when the issue isn't fully understood or the committee just wants to get that kind of face-to-face interaction with the petitioner to really be clear about, you know, what's being put before them. The other key, I would say, criteria is the time available for our committee to meet to take evidence. So the committee have a huge programme of commitments, which includes taking evidence from Scottish Government ministers or other kind of key stakeholders. They often choose to do roundtable evidence sessions. All of that takes a huge amount of time to plan and organise and, I guess, program in for the committee's work program. The committee work meets fortnightly, so that becomes an even further restriction on the time available for the committee to hear directly from petitioners. But it is a very firm commitment that the committee have, which is they want to hear directly from the people of Scotland, because that's the whole point of the public petitions process, is to hear directly and to have their engagement, although, as I say, it's just not possible for it from everybody's perspective.
Yeah. And when you talk about lack of information, so you've got to go and search more information from the petitioners, does the committee staff often do a bit of research before you get to that point? Like, does it often come as a recommendation from the committee staff?
For every petition that is published, our in-house research department will prepare a briefing. So that provides the baseline position for information. However, there's an opportunity for some of that information to be tested or inquired further with the petitioner. And also, as much as it's important to stay factual, it also, particularly if it's something that's perhaps a health matter or something that maybe the committee just don't have a handle on, it's the opportunity to hear the very direct impact it's had on a petitioner or a group of people and what that means for the delivery of services in Scotland. So it's that very real direct impact that the committee can really tease by having the information to hand through the briefing, but also hearing it directly from the petitioner. Steve, were you going to come in at all there?
Yeah, maybe just to touch on the point that Lynn was making about the selection of petitioners for all evidence. Whilst, of course, we can't hear from everyone, what we do is we make it very clear to all petitioners that, you know, not being given the opportunity to give all evidence, if you like, doesn't devalue their petition. That every petition is treated in the same way, and the committee will look at the petition in as much detail as it would had we heard all the evidence. So we're very clear to make that point to petitioners so that, again, they feel valued and that their engagement is as valid as anyone who is selected to give all the evidence. And just on the research point that Lynn made, we do try to ensure that before the petition is first considered by the committee that they have knowledge of recent developments in the relevant policy area, whether the government is perhaps consulting on the issue that the petitioner is interested in, whether there's been other parliamentary activities such as debates or questions from members, just so they have a full picture before they receive the petition as to what's been happening in that area. And that will then prompt the action by the committee when they do consider it as to whether further information is required from the government, from other stakeholders, as we progress.
Yeah.
There's just two further points that if you'll allow it, just to make you aware of, is whilst people can't sometimes aren't able or aren't invited to provide oral evidence, there's always a route in to members of the public to provide a written submission. I know your system seems slightly different to ours. We don't invite the petitioner, once they've made a petition, submitted a petition, we don't ask for any further information, because we really see that as their position statement. There's an opportunity to provide that background information, so that would be the baseline for us. But if members of the public feel disappointed that they've not had their opportunity to come before the committee, we will always make them aware that they can provide a written submission at any time if they want the committee to know further information ahead of the committee consideration. And we spoke about public expectation a little while ago, and again, it'll come as no surprise, but there are a lot of people who think it's a kind of automatic right to go before the committee, and that's despite it being very clear in guidance as to it's not a kind of, it will not happen by automatic kind of processes. It's a selection process. So expectation is high, and we do a lot of work even on that side of things just to manage expectations and alternative ways that the petitioner can engage in the process if they're not coming straight before the committee for the first time.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good point you make about the differences. Often, we rely on petitioners to make a submission to further define the issue, really, even if it's from a biased viewpoint. So they're probably the first step in our research, in a sense. And then potentially we've got other ways of dealing with it and to test the veracity of their evidence themselves. So I think it's an interesting point that we probably need to think about a bit more about how we inject committee research into the process, probably. But that's just a comment from me. Yeah. I'm on to sort of question four or where we sent to you. And I note that your public petitions committee has a remit to consider petitions, whereas our terms of reference talks about inquire into and report on. And I guess it comes back to that setting of expectations from a petitioner. What do you think about our wording versus yours?
Well, I think that we can obviously only kind of refer to like our own terms of reference, and perhaps it might be helpful to explain why we've gone down the particular route that we have with our language.
That'd be great.
In that there's a key distinction for the Scottish Parliament between the consideration of a petition and an inquiry. So, as you may have already picked up, each admissible petition is considered, so we will take evidence, we'll gather information in written and oral formats to allow the committee to make a decision about what happens next with that petition. Inquiries in the Scottish Parliament context are a lot more structured, a lot more detailed and quite targeted in their focus, and they can involve a lot of kind of programmes of a clear, consistent programme of taking oral evidence, extensive evidence gathering and producing inquiry reports. So there's a key distinction, as I say, between this consideration, which the committee will take on all petitions, and an inquiry, which is a very specific piece of work. Now, the committee, the Public Petitions Committee, don't take a lot of inquiries. We are actually conducting one at the moment on youth mental health services. So we need to be very clear about the terminology and the language that we use within the Scottish Parliament. The other point I would probably want to make here is that we consider every public petition to be almost like a mini inquiry. Because it does do a lot of the things that a formal inquiry would, but I think it's very important for the Scottish Parliament that we distinguish between that consideration and a very formal established process that happens across all committees in the Scottish Parliament, which is this targeted and very specific inquiry piece of work. And we wouldn't ever want that to be confused or raise the expectation for the petitioner. So consideration is a really good, consistent and clear way of trying to explain why that's different for us from an inquiry. Again, we talk a lot about public expectation, and I think it's you know, from my own experience, there's a high level of public expectation as to what will happen and the terminology that's used. So I'm not entirely sure that the language really matters that much, because there's always going to be that expectation as to something big's going to happen with a petition. So consideration require, there's a debate as to whether or not that would make a difference to a petitioner on the street, but we need to be clear in our terminology. So hopefully that's set out our position a bit more clearly for you.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point you make, in that if when you start you changing your language, it sort of gives a bit of a different status to where the petition is at, or the inquiry, or the consideration of the petition is at. And I think that's something we should consider absolutely, about how do we set that up so that we know that, okay, we're going to look into every petition that gets presented, but that doesn't mean it's going to end up in an inquiry. And maybe we just need to tinker with some of our language to help set that expectation, would be my comment from what you said. I think it was valuable. Yeah.
Maybe if I could add, I think sure. When the petition system was first set up, I think it was the petition committee, if you like, was almost viewed as a clearinghouse, if you like, for petitions. The initial consideration, which would then be either a petition being referred on to a subject committee, you know, a transport petition going to a transport committee, a health committee, a health committee, and so on. And wouldn't actually decide on things itself and produce recommendations. I think that was very much the early view of the Parliament and how it would operate. So it would either refer it on, or it would close it down and dismiss it. But as the committee evolved and actually became more confident in its own setup and operations, if you like it, it started to dig deeper into issues, either before it referred on to a subject committee, or actually, as Lynn said, we decided to conduct on occasion its own inquiry if it felt strongly about an issue and perhaps workloads in other committees weren't sufficient to take on a new piece of work. So, you know, the petitioner's role, if you like, has changed from being that sort of clearinghouse idea to doing a very thorough examination and consideration of petitions to really establish whether it does have merit and you know, to lead to further action, whether that's, you know, recommendation to the Scottish Government or referral to a subject committee. So I think the committee has grown arms and legs, if you like, over the 20-year period, where it's moved from this idea that it would just consider very briefly to actually detailed consideration, which I think is really, you know, helpful in terms of, you know, enhancing public engagement with the Parliament.
Yeah, I think that's just tweaked something else with my mind too, is obviously, he called it a clearinghouse in the early days. I would assume that you still get quite frivolous or repetitive petitions that the committee still need to play a clearinghouse role for, or have the petitions got more sophisticated in terms of what they want to see happen from a Scottish Parliament point of view?
I think petitions vary, and a lot of that's down to the issue, it's down to the understanding of the system by the petitioner. But certainly, I mean, we have, I think, the suggestion that we don't deal with frivolous petitions, for example, was something we introduced quite a few years ago, because we do occasionally, and I do stress occasionally, get petitions where, you know, it's a bit fairly light-hearted or a response to something that's happening in the media or you know, a political statement, if you like, which is meant to not necessarily serious. And we put that in basically to try and avoid a misuse of the system and a misuse of valuable parliamentary time, if you like. But these are few and far between, but we're confident that we now have that safeguard in our processes, that where we do get something that's genuinely frivolous, we can essentially dismiss it. But we, you know, in doing so, we provide reasons for that, and backed up by our guidelines and our guidance.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Sorry, yeah, go.
No, I just wanted to make or stress the point that often if we do get petitions on the basis that Steve has explained, it wouldn't necessarily go before the committee. It wouldn't come anywhere near the committee because the clerking team are there to I guess, provide that first line of mm-hmm. review. And obviously a frivolous petition wouldn't be considered an admissible one, and the committee only consider admissible petitions. So the chances of the committee seeing something like that or really being brought into the public domain are really pretty slim. And the other point I just wanted to make is often if a petition is frivolous, there's other reasons why it's not admissible. They've not done other key criterion in order for the petition to really have legs and to go before the committee. So I would stress again, we don't tend to get a huge amount of frivolous petitions, and where we do, there's a multiple number of reasons why they wouldn't be considered admissible and therefore go before the committee for formal consideration.
Yeah, so that's really interesting.
Over the years, it's that realisation that these petitions will appear that has led us to improving our guidance and our processes, so they don't, as Lynn said, don't come near the committee. The clerks have delegated responsibility, if you like, to root these out, because clearly they don't have substance, they don't have merit. So rather than coming to the committee to make that decision, as Lynn says, it's that the clerks are able to, with the confidence of the members of the committee, make those decisions on their behalf.
Yeah, so that's where I was going to try to go to is that delegated authority for the clerk to make the decision. Is that a formal process, or is it set down in any standing order, or is it kind of just agreed to between the committee at the time with the clerk, or how is it set down, I guess?
Well, I suppose it's more a convention than a rule,
right.
But it has been agreed by various iterations of the committee over the years that when we're changing processes in this way, we the clerks don't just make that arbitrary decisions. We take detailed papers to the committee to explain the rationale behind differences in approach and
right.
We manage the system. So we get buy-in that way. That's all recorded in our papers, so we can always refer back to that if it's challenged by members. And we're actually going through that a bit of a similar process at the moment, where we're streamlining some of our operations. Some of which are in a way to actually deal with the sort of repetitive element that you've mentioned, of petitions, to find a way of ensuring that we don't just keep repeat petitions from the same people who've called up the system when they've had a very clear answer to a petition previously. And they try to, go around our standing orders and our rules by changing the wording of a petition slightly to change the emphasis, perhaps. So we're looking at ways all the time to improve the system, primarily so that individuals don't clog up the system to the detriment of other petitioners who are coming forward perhaps for the first time.
Yeah. Would you be able to show us or submit a document that sort of documents that rationale between the clerk and the committee? In terms of, I've viewed this petition and I've decided it's not worth coming to the committee for consideration. Is there any, can you provide us with any documents about that process, just to provide us with some solid evidence?
I think we could certainly endeavour to do that. I think probably the frivolous petitions discussion probably may have been 10, 12 years ago, but such are our records, I'm sure we'll be able to dig out something that can point you to the discussion that we had with our members and the way we presented that, that argument, if you like. So absolutely, we can certainly endeavour to look at our records.
If there's been some recent decisions by the clerk to say, well, this petition is not worthy of going to the committee for these reasons, I think even that would be valuable insight for us if we're talking about a first pass by the committee staff or the clerk themselves. It would be useful for us, I think, because we go straight into submissions and then we deal with it post that. So we view every petition that comes being it frivolous or not. And sometimes it can really clog up the committee if we go through the process. So any help on that sense would be great.
Maybe just from a practical perspective, just as a clerk, we ding on a lot of this stuff. We often will go back with clear rationales to why something hasn't been deemed admissible, and we always invite the petitioner to make those changes to make it admissible if there's something perhaps that they can do. I would say experience has told me that most of the time people accept our rationale and either make those changes or we never hear from them again. Right. What doesn't tend to happen, is we don't get a lot of pushback or, challenge to our process, because we're quite clear and documented as to why something hasn't met with the rules. But if we did, and I stress we've never really had this in my lifetime anyway, it would go before the committee. If there was some form of a dispute, it would go before the committee for consideration.
Yeah.
But we seldom, in fact, never in my lifetime have ever had that challenge function where we've had to have anything like that happen.
Yeah. So any information you could provide this committee on that sort of process would be quite valuable to us, I believe, if possible. Perhaps we'll move on to, and this is related, and I'm talking about question 5 that we provided to you, which is about your template asks for previous action taken, whereas we don't ask for any of that sort of stuff here in WA or Western Australia. And I guess it's about the providing evidence. Do you actually ask the petitioners to provide evidence about what steps they've taken to resolve the issue before they get in a petition, put in a petition?
That's a really, really good question, actually. Our current processes are that we ask the petitioner what other avenues they have taken to address get their issue addressed. So that could be contacting their elected representative or speaking directly with the Scottish Government, perhaps an official who has a policy background leading that area. However, we don't validate any of this information. We take petitioners at their word, and as Steve mentioned earlier, we ourselves are looking at ways in which we can continue to improve. And there's been some appetite for perhaps making that process a little bit more robust.
Yep.
So rather than just at the moment, we would take, as previous action, I spoke to my local elected representative, full stop. What we would be maybe asking for is, well, what was the outcome of that discussion or that conversation, so that the committee can be a bit more assured that it's this, that the public petitions process hasn't been the first port of call just to get their voice heard. They've actually tried other mechanisms to really have their issue addressed. Hopefully that kind of answers your question on that front.
Well, just says that you're basically taking the word of the petitioner in a sense, which is, you know, that's fine. It's just about how we go further than that to help the committee deal with it in a more timely way, or in a more fairer way, really. Because there's no point if the petitioner, the committee makes their inquiries and decides that, oh, you should go and see the ombudsman, when they could have gone and seen the ombudsman in the first instance. You know, that you're trying to get an outcome for them. You're not trying to waylay the process, really. So if they can provide evidence of it and they didn't get there, then sure, fine. But yeah.
On that point, I think it's important to highlight that the petitions process isn't a route for kind of individual complaints or something of a local matter that wouldn't engage the public petitions committee remit at all. So if it was a clear issue that was for the Ombudsman to take forward, the committee, wouldn't go before the committee again, as I said already. The clerks would filter that out and direct or signpost that petitioner to the most appropriate decision maker for that issue. But as I stress again, the committee would not look at an individual complaint or an individual matter because it's not part of their remit at all.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Yeah, I remember. My first term on this committee, we got a petition about changing a bus stop about 200 metres. And we had to deal with it like we always did. It was like, come on, go and see the Minister for Transport or the Department of Transport and put your case and get it solved, you know? Anyway.
Quite often, if a member of the public really wants to pursue an issue, we would invite them to consider raising their issue in national terms. So it may well be that we say, you know, a strategic review of how bus stops are positioned in Scotland. it really does get to the heart of the matter that they're looking to address. So we would probably, as I say, signpost them to the more appropriate decision maker rather than.
Yeah, much better idea.
Yeah.
We deal with a lot of planning. We get quite a lot of petitions on planning, and mostly about people disagreeing with planning outcomes, either from a statewide planning perspective or even a local government planning perspective. And we're not the decision-making body for those planning, but they petition us anyway. Have you guys had any experience, or do you get many of those planning issue petitions type things, and then how do you manage them and outcomes and expectations?
Yeah, I think in the early days we certainly did get quite a few of these types of petitions. I think people saw the petition system as being another way of achieving their objective, if perhaps they had seen a planning application rejected, or from a community perspective, a planning application granted, which actually they felt, didn't fit with their community objectives or whatever. However, very early on, we took the view that it would not be appropriate for the petitions system to try to become involved in or be seen as some sort of secondary decision maker on those areas where there is another body which has that responsibility. So we said that very clearly in guidance, and a point we made was that these are decisions that are properly set out in legislation to be the decisions of local authorities in Scotland. And actually, even when we get to the position of Scottish ministers, they are not able to engage with those decisions. They can't give a view on whether a local authority should grant a planning permission, and that then moves up a level to the Parliament. So why would that be appropriate?
Yeah, yeah.
We have a process of planning appeals in Scotland, where planning appeals can be judged by ministers, and there's a distinct process set in legislative terms that governs that. So there are routes for all these things to happen. But what we do, and Lynn touched on it there a moment ago, that if through highlighting a particular planning decision or a process undertaken by a local authority that highlights a flaw in the petition's legislation or a process, that would be legitimate because it raises it to a national level and doesn't deal with the actual application for a housing development or a retail park or whatever. But what it does is it highlights perhaps a way in which a process can be improved, perhaps to say make it more sustainable, introduce new environmental impact assessments or whatever. You can see that would be legitimate.
Yeah,
because it addresses improvements to an existing policy, which would actually apply to future applications or future appeals in the planning process. So that's the way we've made that very clear distinction. Current live applications, we don't go there, we make that very clear.
Yeah.
However, if it's a legislative process and how that can be enhanced, we can certainly consider that.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice distinction and something we should think about. But my question was back to how did the committee or the parliament set up that expectation of we're not dealing with a planning issue that's live? It was just a committee decision? Was it part of the committee rules or a convention? Or was it actually when the first committee started and was established, that was kind of like that's the expectation from the parliament?
Well, I think what happened is we started by going through the processes that we go through with every petition, looking at the merits of the petition. But the very clear message coming back, set out in the the view we're getting from the Scottish Government, was actually, and our own researchers here, were setting out in very clear terms how the planning system operates and where the lines of decision making lie. So it became a very obvious that it was entirely inappropriate. It wasn't really a choice by the Parliament or whatever. It was actually, in legislative terms, it just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
And actually, we may have found that the Parliament would have been going out with its competence, if you like, to make those decisions, because these have been given to local authorities in Scotland by legislation, by primary legislation.
Yeah.
So I think it emerged very early on that it would be entirely inappropriate for the Parliament to engage in those sort of decisions.
Yeah. And then the clerk just made those decisions then, basically, and said, the clerk themselves made that decision then and said, this is not going to the committee because it's a planning issue.
Do you mind if I quickly confirm that in our standing orders, there's a clear line about petitions are not admissible if they don't cover an issue of national policy or practice. So that is a driving force for how you can't ever argue that a local government decision, like a planning matter for a specific local matter, could be considered an area of something of national importance or significance.
Yep.
So that's often a starting point for the clerks to really handle those types of issues.
I like it.
Well, I think the early days, answer to your question, I think the committee did consider this as an issue, advised by the clerks in terms of their position. And the committee was very clear in the early days, it would not, it would stand by the standing orders requirements and it would be in the legislative framework to ensure that it acted appropriately. So that's been a sort of legacy issue, if you like, but we have precedent that was set out in the early days, and from then on, the committee has sort of stuck to that line.
Yeah. No. Very useful useful evidence, thank you. Probably go to question 8 of those questions we gave to you, which is, you probably answered a bit about this, and this is about the repetitive nature of some of the petitions. And there's a number of questions there, but I think we've answered most of them, unless you want to make any other comment based around the dealing with or the determination of repetitive petitions?
No, I mean, if you feel that the question's been answered, then I'm happy enough with that. I'm conscious that we've got a lot to get through in a short period of time.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
if you feel
yeah.
you've got everything you need, then absolutely happy just to leave it there.
Sure. I just wanted to make sure you hadn't written some notes that you want to make sure we heard. One of the things our committee does here is when we close petitions, we don't necessarily give the reasons for closing a petition. And it probably needs some thinking about in terms of managing the expectations about and the open and transparency of the role that the committee plays. You give reasons for closing a petition and as you pointed out, if it doesn't go to the committee, there's reasonings why it hasn't gone forward. What about when it gets to the committee themselves and they decide to close a petition? Is reasoning given?
Yeah, it is given. I think we feel that's an important part of the process in terms of, as you mentioned, managing expectations, so that rather than just your petition is closed and no background given to that, it's very important that the petitioner understands the way in which the committee has taken forward its consideration of issues, and that's documented, of course, by all the various submissions that we receive, so the petitioner can clearly see that. But ultimately, the committee has to make a decision based on that evidence, and when it does, the committee is very clear the reasoning why a petition has been closed. Whether it's the government has explained that actually the policy area, for example, that has been the subject of the petition is actually fit for purpose and works well. We make that clear. Or if there's another route by which the petitioner could realise their objective, we would set that out in the letter notifying of closure. So I think it's very important as we go through the whole process and come to the end of it, that the committee can provide some justification for its action in closing the petition, whether that's to refer them to do something else or to give a good reasoned argument, if you like, as to why a petition has been closed. And that also guards against, I think, perhaps a petitioner being further frustrated and coming back with a further petition later if they can clearly see the reasons behind a petition closure. And
then
that's really just
one. Yeah. No,
that correspondence goes out in the convener's name, so it's very important that the convener has that direct kind of closure the link is closed with the convener.
Yep. No, that's very useful. And how does the committee report to Parliament on its activities or its inquiries or its outcome?
Well, just in terms of ordinary petitions, I mean, there's no requirement to report to Parliament, if you like, but in saying that, everything is documented on our website and it's available for all members to see. Clearly, when we conduct our own inquiries, there is a report to Parliament on those inquiries, and Lynn is pulling together a report on the committee's more recent inquiry at the moment. And once that report is produced, the committee would actually hold a formal debate in the Chamber of the Parliament on the outcome from that inquiry.
Yep.
So that they can present their recommendations to Parliament, other members of the Parliament can engage, and that will prompt a requirement for a formal response to that report from the Scottish Government.
Yep.
Both in writing and during that debate. So, that's the way we would take that forward in terms of widening the Parliament's understanding and awareness of the issues covered.
Yep. No, we do the same thing here in terms of committee reports on inquiries. We present it back to Parliament for debate and a response from government. When someone presents a petition, does it get read into your Parliament or does it just go straight to the committee and bypasses the Parliament?
When would you like to cover that?
So,
well,
I'll just give you... Maybe I can give it a put in context for you. So every petition that comes to the Legislative Council of Western Australia gets read in by a member. And so it's presented to Parliament, and then basically the House of the Legislative Council sends it to its delegated committee, which is us. So it's got a very much a parliamentary role as much as a committee role. And so then there's an expectation, in my view, that the committee report back to the chamber who sent it to them. But do you have that sort of system in Scotland?
No, we don't have that process in place. The only thing really that happens in terms of raising the profile of petitions that have been published on our website is we have a business bulletin, which essentially outlines all the work of the Parliament that's currently ongoing or has been introduced. So that includes things like bills that have been laid before Parliament. So if we have any new petitions that have been published or lodged, we would include that within the business bulletin, which is usually a daily occurrence during when Parliament's sitting. Also, I mentioned earlier that the people can say they've spoken to their elected representative as part of the petitioning process. That doesn't necessarily mean that member either agrees or wants to support the petition, but it's just that they've been able to demonstrate a route that they've taken to try and address the issue. But there's no formal stamping by an elected representative to get it on, I guess, the books of the Parliament. It doesn't quite work like that in Scotland, no.
No. Okay. No, that's good.
Also worth making the distinction that I was having a look at your own processes prior to this session to the members and so forth. I mean, I did pick up that it's for a member to read that into the Parliament so it can then be taken forward and delegated to your committee. It was part of our sort of founding approach, if you like, to the petition system, that there should be no requirement for a member to be involved. This should be a direct, absolutely direct method of engagement by the Scottish people, and they shouldn't have to rely on convincing a member that their argument was sound or held merit.
Yeah.
There should be a direct route into the systems and processes of the Parliament, so it was genuine public engagement as opposed to something that had to go through various stages prior to that. So that's a very clear distinction. It's been in place since day one. We have never had a requirement for a member to sponsor a petition, if you like, or read it into the record before it's taken forward.
Yeah, I would say that any member who gets approached to read in a petition reads it in by convention.
Yeah.
So even they may not agree with the substance of the petition, there's still kind of like an obligation to read it in, really. So, and I think from my viewpoint, I think it's a valuable part of the process because we are a committee of the House, and so the issue probably should come through the House, in my view. But, it's just a slight distinction, that's all. Hmm. We're almost near the end, so there's probably a few questions we haven't quite got to, but I'm really interested in if you can provide some insight into the decision-making of the committee, and you may not, of course, but how the committees go decide if they're going to do an inquiry or they're going to bring in some oral evidence or they're going to take it further. Is there any written guidelines to help the committee get to that process or get through that process, or is the decision making purely innate within the members themselves?
I think every journey is different, and there's no clear set rule book as to any key stages that the committee should take on the consideration of the petition. It's very much an organic and evolving process for every issue that's considered. One thing I would highlight is that if, say, the committee have written to the Scottish Government, they've received a response back that they are not happy with or they feel has dodged an issue, they may either decide to write to the government again or actually just bring the minister in to kind of address the issues directly. Quite often that can be a bit of a process where they start off, writing back and forward, but then if there's a sense of frustration that they're perhaps not, the government aren't quite addressing the issues, that's where the committee might want to progress things further and take the issues forward in that format. Often as well, I mentioned that the committee might want to take roundtable evidence sessions. So if there's an issue, but there's no clear solution as to what needs to happen to make this issue better or, you know, improve the situation. And quite often the committee might think, well, okay, let's get key stakeholders around the table and let's try and tease out what needs to change in order for things to improve. And then, you know, that gets reflected back to government and we seek government views. So there's a lot of back and forward, but it is, as I say, very nuanced and there's no clear guidelines that set out how things happen for each position. Steve, I don't know if you wanted to come in on anything on that from.
No, I think that's right. I mean, it goes right back to the sort of basic sort of fundamental approach taken by the committee, that it really is just about the merits of the petition. And importantly, the evidence that the committee receives, as Luna's pointed out, and whether that then prompts further you know, a requirement for further evidence or, you know, to bring in a minister to justify what was set out in written evidence, that sort of thing. So it very much dealt with on a case-by-case basis, you know, the members obviously play a full part in that, and they will respond and react to the evidence received, perhaps in, you know, slightly different ways. So yeah, it's a case-by-case basis essentially, and we try to provide as much support and guidance to members as part of that process.
Yep. Okay. Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. I think we've covered most of the questions. Would you like to make any closing comments, or you think we might have missed something from your perspective?
Certainly from my perspective, I think we've had a good discussion, but I think we'll just extend the offer that, you know, if you or your clerk and colleagues would like to contact us for any further information. We have noted some of the information that we can provide for you, but I think we certainly view, you know, over the past 20 years has been very much a growing community, if you like, of petitions, systems and processes in the legislatures around the world, and we are very keen to engage with yourselves and others as we learn from each other, if you like. So any further information you would like from us, please contact us. And we look forward to seeing how your own system develops, and would value some feedback on that at some point. If you produce a report from this exercise, for example,
sure,
we would be that of interest.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll make sure we do. Yeah, thank you. And Ms. Russell, any final comment from you? Or
One thing I just wanted to kind of, I know there was a question in the question that we've been sent for through about referrals, and just highlighting that very important fact that what the committee never try and do is duplicate scrutiny. So what we try and do with referrals, if there's another committee that perhaps is best placed to do something, particularly if it's got an ongoing inquiry into the issue, we will very quickly try to identify that and have that good kind of close working with the clerk and colleagues and other subject committees to make sure that committees don't just run in parallel to something that's either being considered by way of a piece of legislation, or if they're doing an inquiry themselves on the issue. So we're very keen, because the petition system, we're a busy committee, we get a lot of petitions through our books, so we want to make sure we're as smart and as agile as possible by making sure there is no duplication of scrutiny that goes on within the Parliament. So it was really just to highlight that point and how important that is to ensure that we all use our time wisely in the Parliament.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's an important point, I think. Yeah. I've just got to read a closing statement. So thanks for attending again today. A transcript of this hearing will be forwarded to you for correction. If you believe that any corrections should be made because of typographical or transcription errors, please indicate these corrections on the transcripts. Errors of fact or substance must be corrected in a formal letter to the committee.